Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Grantville Gazette, Volume 2, edited and created by Eric Flint, narrated by P.J. Oakland. Preface. Eric Flint. As you can perhaps deduce from the simple existence of the second volume of the electronic magazine The Grantville Gazette, the first issue, which we did as an experiment to see if there would be enough interest in such an oddball publication, proved to be successful. Quite successful, in fact. Better than either I or my publisher, Jim Bain, had expected. The magazine's been doing well also. Five volumes of the Gazette have been published thus far, with more issues in the works. Now that I know the Gazette will be an ongoing project, at least in electronic format, I've got more leeway in terms of the kind of stories I can include in the magazine. A number of the fiction pieces being written in the 1632 setting are either long or are intended as parts of ongoing stories. There are two examples in this issue: Danita Ewing's An Invisible War and Enrico Toro's Euterpe, Episode 1. In terms of its length, An Invisible War is technically a short novel. In the electronic edition, it was serialized over two issues of the magazine, the second half appearing in Volume 3. Since that wouldn't be suitable for a paper edition, I included the entire novel in this volume. Enrico Toro's story is somewhat different. Neither he nor I know what the final length of this story will be. Not to mention that in later volumes of the magazine, his story begins to intertwine with a series written by David Carrico. Euterpe is written in the form of episodes, each told in epistolary form by the narrator. I wanted to include it because, along with Gorg Huff's story, God's Gifts, Toro's piece approaches the 1632 framework entirely from the angle of how 17th century people react to the events produced by the Ring of Fire. Most of the stories that appeared in either the first volume of the Gazette or the anthology Ring of Fire approach the situation either entirely or primarily from the standpoint of American uptimers. What I especially liked about the stories by Toro and Huff is that uptimers are never the viewpoint characters. In the case of Euterpe, Toro is using an actual historical figure and trying to imagine how a young musician of the time would react to the sudden influx of music written over the next several centuries. In the case of Huff's story, the character is a fictional Lutheran pastor trying to grapple with the theological implications of the Ring of Fire. Given that there are a few thousand uptimers in the 1632 setting and tens of millions of downtimers, it seemed about time to me that we started getting more of their view of things into the series. Although not quite to the same degree, Chris Webber's short novella, The Company Men, also approaches the setting primarily from the standpoint of 17th century figures. In the case of his story, which is an adventure story, that of two mercenary soldiers of the time. And in John Zeke's murder mystery, Bottom Feeders, we get a nice mix of viewpoints. There's a nice mix of stories in this issue, I think, in more ways than one. They range from military stories like Mike Spehar's Collateral Damage, through stories involving the struggle to establish modern medical care, Ewing's An Invisible War, and everything in between. The same is true for the factual articles, where you'll get a treatise on 17th century swordplay, as well as a discussion of the practical challenges posed by geology and mining in the context of the technical resources available to the characters in the series. There are a number of questions audiences have asked me concerning where the 1632 series is going, the status of various novels in the series, especially 1634, The Baltic War, which is the direct sequel to 1633, and how and where the Gazette fits into that. Since answering those questions takes a fair amount of space, I'll deal with them in the afterword at the end of the book. I think prefaces are best kept short and sweet. Fiction. Steps in the Dance. Eric Flint.
"Stop whining, Harry," said Anne Jefferson. "If I can do it, you can do it."
"No way am I posing half-naked," growled her male companion.
He gripped the rifle with both hands, as if ready to deal with any threatening horde. Any horde. Mongols, Huns,
famous artists. Ha! Huh. The truth about Macho Man exposed to the world at last. A coward. A craven. Anne swiveled her head to give him her best sneer, even if it was mostly wasted in the twilight. The lamps, which were starting to be lit in front of the taverns on the street in Amsterdam, didn't yet add much to the illumination.
"I'm not a coward," Harry Lefferts insisted stubbornly. "And I'm not craving anything at the moment, except relief from pushy women."
He tried a lusty grin directed at Anne. Alas, it was a pale version of her sneer.
"Not relief from all women, of course. Just pushy ones. If you were to change your ways..."
"I'd call that a nice try, except it's so feeble."
She tried to stride forward, but the combination of the absurd sorta wedding dress she was wearing, the cobblestone street, and her 17th-century Dutch version of high heels caused her to stumble. Fortunately, Adam Olearius was there to catch her arm and keep her standing, if not exactly steady. He'd been walking alongside her ever since they'd left the USE embassy, and he'd listened to the repartee between Anne and Harry, smiling as he did so. By now, several weeks after Harry's arrival in Amsterdam, Adam had long since recognized that Harry was not a rival, despite the young American's seemingly irrepressible flirting. In fact, he'd rather come to like the man, even if he was a little scary at times. Scary this time, too, in a way. Adam had been keeping an eye out for the possibility that Anne might stumble, which Harry had not. Adam had a very personal interest in the young woman, and was more familiar than either of his companions with the hazards of negotiating the streets of the era. The cobblestones, as such, hadn't caused Anne to stumble. Rather, her shoe had skidded in the material covering one of the stones. There were unfortunate consequences to using horses for transport in cities. Partly, too, because Adam Olearius was a more solicitous man by nature than Harry Lefferts was or ever would be. And finally, being honest, because he was not preoccupied with the prospect of shortly becoming the model for one of the half-dozen most famous artists of the time. Of all times, actually, judging from the American history books Adam had read. So he'd been half expecting the stumble, and was there almost instantly. But Harry was only a split second behind him. Somehow he managed to shift his grip on the rifle and his footing in order to seize Anne's other elbow, with such speed and grace that Adam was not really able to follow the motions. In the 3 short years since the Ring of Fire, Harry Lefferts had become a rather notorious figure in certain European circles, for several reasons, one of which was his skill as a duelist. Seeing the way he moved, Adam had no trouble understanding the reason. Yes, frightening in its way, especially given the man's incredibly sanguine temperament. Fortunately for the world, Harry was also, as a rule, quite a good-natured fellow. He was not actually given to picking fights, Adam had concluded, after observing him for several weeks. He was simply very, very, very good at ending them, and instantly ready to do so if someone else was foolish enough to begin the affair. That notoriety, of course, did not fit well with Harry's official role as a combination secret agent and what the Americans called a commando. Anne Jefferson had teased him about it. The other 2 women in the USE embassy in Amsterdam had not. Rebecca Abravanel had subjected him to a long, solemn lecture on the subject. Gretchen Richter had subjected him to a short and blistering excoriation. Blistering, indeed. Adam happened to have been there himself to hear it. The expression one of the uptimers had used afterward struck him as most appropriate. "She really peeled the paint off the walls, didn't she?" Had she been a man, her tirade might have led to a challenge. Although, perhaps not. Adam was pretty sure that Gretchen Richter was one of the few people in the world who intimidated Harry Lefferts. If not as proficient as he was with weapons, she was every bit as ready to employ them,
and with attitudes as sanguine as his, and then some. There was more to it, though. Autumn knew, at least in its general outlines, how Harry had first met the woman, very shortly after the Ring of Fire. Shithouse Gretchen was the way Harry sometimes referred to her, when she'd done something to get on his nerves. But he never said it in front of her, and there was always more than a trace of grudging respect even when he did. In the end, for all his often debonair manners and the way he was idolized by a number of young European gentry and noblemen, Harry Lefferts was a hillbilly and a former coal miner. Getting one's hand dirty and being willing to do so was something he deeply respected. Oddly enough, Harry's thoughts seemed to have been running parallel to Autumn's. After Anne's footing was steady again, Harry released her elbow and went back to his grumbling.
"And why me, anyway? Shithouse Gretchen's built like a damn brick shithouse, and she's willing to pose."
"Don't be vulgar, Harry," scolded Anne.
"Who's being vulgar? The truth is what it is. Those tits of hers would intimidate a Playboy bunny, and it's not as if she's kept them under wraps. Not hardly. Not after she posed for Rembrandt."
He barked a laugh that was half sarcasm and half genuine humor.
"Ha! You watch, Anne. Give it a century or two and that damn painting will be hanging in the Louvre. Or the, what's it called? That famous museum in Spain? The Pardo, I think. Lines of tourists a mile long all shuffling past to stare at the world's most famous tits."
Olearius suspected he was right. He'd seen the painting himself, on the two previous occasions when he'd visited the mansion where the Spanish had set up their headquarters for the siege of Amsterdam. The enemy commander, the Cardinal Infante Don Fernando, had it prominently displayed in his salon. A bit odd, that was, given that the painting romanticized Don Fernando's stubborn Dutch opponents. Rembrandt's whimsical version of the future painting by Eugène Delacroix, which would have been called Liberty Leading the People, depicted a bare-breasted Gretchen Richter holding a flag on the ramparts of Spanish-besieged Amsterdam. Had the Spanish commander of that siege been a different sort of man, Olearius would have assumed nothing more was involved than any man's interest in such a remarkable female form. But, no, that wasn't it. To be sure, for all his slender, red-headed, boyish appearance, Don Fernando was a very vigorous man, and not one upon whom his official title as a cardinal weighed any too heavily. But he was no bumpkin either, easily distracted by mere lust. Olearius was quite an experienced diplomat, and he'd already come to the conclusion that Don Fernando was as shrewd as any prince in the long and successful history of the Habsburg dynasty. If Don Fernando had chosen to have that painting prominently displayed in his headquarters, there was a political reason for it. More likely, several reasons. Don Fernando could be surprisingly subtle for such a young man.
"Shit,"
Anne muttered. Olearius glanced over and saw that she'd finally spotted the cause of her mishap. They'd reached a well-illuminated corner, and the contents smeared across the sole of her shoe and partway up the sides were now easily visible and quite evident.
"Yeah, sure is," said Harry cheerfully. "Look on the bright side, though. It's just horse shit. Someday I'll tell you about the time Gerd and me had to wade through. No, it's too disgusting."
He started to reach for the handkerchief he had in his pocket, but Autumn had already drawn out his own and offered it to Anne.
"Thanks,"
she said, smiling at him warmly. But the smile vanished as soon as she spotted the men starting to spill out of the tavern on the corner.
"Oh, damn, here they come. Stand in front of me, guys. Appearances must be maintained."
Autumn and Harry moved to block her from the sight of the night watchman emerging from the tavern. Autumn with a solemn demeanor. Harry, not.
"Stop grinning, Harry,"
Anne hissed, as she stooped down to clean off her shoe.
"Can't help it," he insisted. "Besides, don't get paranoid. I'm not grinning at you. I'm grinning at the flag that guy is carrying."
Olearius had noticed it himself. Anne glanced up from her labor.
"Why is a Dutch soldier carrying a U.S. flag?" she wondered.
"It's a real one, too," Harry said. "Old one, I guess I ought to say. Not the N.U.S. flag. 50 stars.
He seemed genuinely aggrieved.
"Damn. They must have got it from Grantville. Some bums will sell anything."
"They might have made it themselves," Adam pointed out. "Holland is the textile center, after all, and Amsterdam has plenty of seamstresses."
The mystery was solved as soon as the night watch came up. One of them extended the flag to Harry.
"You will need this,"
he explained in heavily accented English.
"Why?"
Harry asked as he took the flag. He used the Dutch word. One of Harry's many talents was a proficiency with languages, and his Dutch had gone from non-existent to semi-passable in just a few short weeks. Semi-passable, at least, for practical purposes like ordering beer and getting directions. There was not much chance he'd be able to argue pre-predestination with Dutch theologians, even assuming Harry had any desire to. A proposition about as unlikely as a Wolverine becoming an opera enthusiast in Adam's estimation. The night watch soldier shrugged.
"Word came from the Spanish to send one with you. The artist requires it, apparently."
That still left the mystery of where the flag came from. But the night watchman answered that also. Smiling, he added,
"We took the one from the tavern wall. Make sure you bring it back. The owner had it made himself, and he likes to keep it up. He thinks it's a good luck charm."
"Well, sure," replied Harry.
Getting through the walls of Amsterdam was easy, of course, with the night watch leading the way to the gate. Getting through the Spanish siege lines beyond to the Cardinal Infante's headquarters proved to be not much more difficult. Spanish officers were waiting to guide them through the maze of trenches and earthworks, all Castilian Hidalgo courtesy. They were respectful toward Autumn, even more respectful if openly curious toward Harry, and, of course, almost effusively gallant toward Anne. There was no fear here that she might stumble on treacherous footing. The Spanish had even laid planks through the trenches solely on her behalf. Even if she had stumbled, the press of officers around her would have prevented any undignified fall.
"Bunch of leches, you ask me," Harry muttered at one point to Autumn. "You better keep your eye on them."
Olearius shook his head.
"Even granted that the Castilian reputation is well deserved, that's really not what's involved here. You forget, Harry. Anne is the one who gave them the chloramphenicol. The formula, at least. Some day that might very well save their lives, and those of their families."
That brought a scowl to Harry's face.
"I still think Mike was crazy to give it to them."
Adam couldn't resist.
"Surely you won't vote for Quentin Underwood in the next election. He shares your opinion, I'm told."
The scowl deepened considerably.
"Not a cold chance in hell. I don't care what fancy positions the bum occupies in the here and now. Far as I'm concerned, he's still the stinking manager of the stinking mine I used to work in. Sooner vote for the devil."
He spread the scowl around.
"Or one of these damn Hidalgos come down to it. Betcha they never heard of forced overtime. Still, Mike was crazy," he concluded stubbornly.
There was a time when Adam Olearius might have agreed with him. But his experiences as a diplomat from the Duchy of Holstein during the Siege of Amsterdam had led him to develop a great respect for the acumen of Mike Stearns and his Sephardic wife. However much Stearns' surreptitious delivery of the formulas for antibiotics to the Spanish might violate the usual notions of strategy, Olearius had decided that the tactic was a splendid illustration of one of those uptime saws he'd become fond of. Crazy like a fox. Lesser statesmen simply thought to defeat their enemies. Stearns was seeking to shatter them into splinters and turn half the splinters into his allies. or at least sideline them into neutrality.
He might very well succeed, too,
Adam thought. How else to explain this night's peculiar expedition, except as one more step in an intricate diplomatic dance? A four-way dance at that. Stearns, his wife, the Prince of Orange, and Don Fernando, and one being invented on the spot. Five-way dance, really, since the Cardinal Infante had to maintain his own sure-footed steps when it came to the reaction of the King of Spain and his notorious chief adviser, the Count Duke of Olivares. They arrived finally. By now the night had settled in, and all that illuminated the Spanish headquarters were sconces and lamps. A multitude of them, with what seemed like mirrors on every wall to enhance the lighting. Amazingly, on the pristine flooring of the entrance salon, Anne stumbled again. But the Cardinal Infante himself was there to catch her. As gallant as any of his officers, he set her back upright with nothing more than a cheerful laugh. As if the younger brother of the Spanish king took assisting common women for granted. He probably didn't look at it that way, however, Adam reflected. Whatever the Americans themselves might think or say or write, or even astonishingly practice at least most of the time, the aristocracy of Europe had generally come to the conclusion that they qualified as nobility. Why not? In the end, if you stripped away all the trappings and the mythologies, the nobility of Europe owed its present exalted position to the crude fact that its ancestors had been the toughest men of their time. That, or the richest, or both. Today, 3 years after the Ring of Fire, only a handful of lunatic counts and the Emperor of the Turks, who was known as Murad the Mad, tried to deny that the Uptimers were both mighty and wealthy. Hearing a little stir behind him, Adam turned and saw that four Spanish officers were clustered around Harry. They were frowning at him, and he was responding with a scowl of his own. Harry had quite a formidable scowl, too. Fortunately, he was not stupid.
"I was told to bring the rifle," he said, almost snarling the words.
In perfectly fluent Spanish, not to Olearius' surprise, albeit with an accent that had more in it of Italy than Castile. He'd originally picked up the language in the course of his journeys with Mazzarini, Adam guessed.
"It's not loaded, you..."
Fortunately, again, Harry left off the rest. He simply, with a quick and smooth motion that made his proficiency with the weapon obvious, drew the bolt and exposed the empty chamber. The Spanish officers clustered around him still more closely. Now, however, with professional interest in the exotic uptime rifle, rather than suspicion. They began peppering Harry with technical questions, which he answered readily. Much more readily than Olearius would have expected, in fact. He suspected that was another subtle step in the dance.
"This is the same sort of rifle that shot Wallenstein at the Alta Vesta?" asked one of the Spaniards.
"Pretty much," Harry replied. "The caliber's slightly different. This is what we call a 30-06.
The four officers eyed him closely.
"Could you make such a shot?"
Harry hesitated for just a split second before answering. Male pride at work, probably. Then, chuckling, he shook his head.
"No, I couldn't. I'm a very good shot, but Julie Sims, McKay now, is just plain out of my league."
"So, it is true. It was a woman who fired that shot."
"Sure was."
Harry held up the rifle a moment, as if studying it.
"With this, and me shooting it, I figure I could hit a target up to 500 yards, maybe six."
The Cardinal Infante had come over himself to follow the conversation. Olearius saw him frown for a moment, as he made the necessary mathematical translations into Spanish distances. The frown was replaced by a look of keen interest.
"That far? Our siege lines are within that range. Some of them well within. Yet you have never shot any of my soldiers.
Harry gave him a look that Aram found it difficult to interpret. Complicated it seemed to be. There was something in there of menace, something of calculation, something of cold amusement, and, yes, exasperation. So, another step in the dance. And as with so many, one that the dancer found too fancy for his taste. Luckily for Europe, Olearius mused, Mike Stearns and not Harry Lefferts was the choreographer here. The Cardinal Infante tossed his head a little.
Tomorrow morning, we will see.
Don Fernando called over his shoulder to the servants against the far wall.
Up in my chamber. There is a old hunting hat in the wardrobe. The one with the red stripe, not the blue one. Bring it down here.
One of the servants sped on his way. All graciousness now, the Cardinal Infante bowed slightly and waved his hand toward a wide door on the side of the salon.
Please, come. Rembrandt is waiting.
The sitting was the usual tedious business. The night watch was kept waiting while Rembrandt concentrated on the portrait of Anne and Harry Lefferts. More precisely, the portrait of Anne, a slim and attractive figure in a white gown, gazing serenely at the flag draped over her lap. All that would ever be seen of Harry was a grim and menacing figure standing guard with a rifle beside her and off to the side, but one whose face was mostly concealed by a caterpillar cap. Harry had insisted on the cap as a condition.
Gotta keep my an anomaly as a secret agent.
Rebecca Abravanel had burst into outright laughter hearing that. Even Gretchen Richter had smiled.
Okay, so I know I'm not pronouncing it right, Harry grumbled. It's still true.
It is not that.
Rebecca held a hand over her mouth to restrain any further laughter.
It is just ridiculous, Gretchen finished for her. Preposterous comes to mind also.
Her smile was gone. She didn't quite glare at Harry. Not quite.
Ridiculous,
she repeated, almost hissing the word.
After the public duels you've fought, not to mention the bastards you've probably left scattered across half of Europe. Secret agent. Ha! Huh.
She began taking toddling little steps across the main salon of the USE Embassy, waving her hands like a small child.
You will see, Mr. Secret Agent, soon pursued by a horde of infants. Papa, papa!
That started Rebecca laughing again. Even Harry had smiled.
Still,
he insisted after she was done.
It's the principle of the thing.
But perhaps it was just as well, Olearius concluded by the end of the evening. Rembrandt had managed to sketch enough of the portrait for the Holstein diplomat to get a sense of the thing. Yes, Anne in that white gown, the purpose for which was now clear, would be the center of it. Anne with her pretty young face and serene expression. Holding the flag the way a young expectant mother might hold a quilt she was making for her coming child. With that dark, grim, faceless, frightening figure in the background, all painted in dark colors except for a gleaming flash from the rifle barrel, to serve the more observant eye as a reminder. Yes, splendid. All the more so in that Olearius was quite certain that the Cardinal Infante had commissioned the painting. Unlike the Trojan horsewoman, this was not a project that Rembrandt had dreamed up himself and then foisted onto a reluctant patron. A reminder. But to whom? The Spanish soldiers? The Cardinal Infante himself? Both? Or perhaps someday he would send it to his older brother, as a way to ameliorate the anger that was already coming from Madrid, or at least provide himself with an excuse.
Done for tonight, Rembrandt pronounced.
As courteous as ever, the great painter was an accomplished diplomat in his own right. He smiled at Anne and Harry. Tomorrow evening.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?